At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Hello, everyone. Today on our show, we have a very special guest, Lila Micklewaite. Lila Micklewaite is the co-founder and CEO of the Justice Defense Fund and leader of the Trafficking Hub Movement, a decentralized and diverse global effort to hold Pornhub accountable for enabling and profiting from criminal sexual abuse. She's been researching and combating the injustice of sex trafficking since 2006 and is a leading expert in the field. Lila's work has been featured in hundreds of news articles worldwide, in outlets such as The New York Times, BBC News, The Guardian, and many others. Her national best-selling book, entitled Takedown, Inside the Fight to Shut Down Pornhub for Child Abuse, Rape, and Sex Trafficking, is a gripping true story of the battle to expose and shut down a criminal online porn empire. You can find more info about Lila and her work at lilamicklewaite.com. Here is Lila now. It is an honor to have Lila Micklewaite with us today. This is such an important subject, and this is something that is so important that you're doing, and I want people to learn about it. And also for us to be able to really tie it in with the theme of the show about manipulation, coercion, indoctrination, how these sorts of situations also shift people's self-concept and how people are either knowingly or totally unwittingly supporting this whole movement. So it ties into so many things. I would love for you to take a moment to introduce yourself and talk a little bit about who you are and what brings you to the show.
Thank you for having me and caring about this subject matter. I know it's a dark subject matter. It's hard to look at, but you know, the only way that we're going to make a difference is by shining a light, a spotlight on it so that people can be aware and then they can do something about it. So thank you. So I have been in the fight against trafficking since, early 2000. So I've been in this 18 years combating sex trafficking. I am the CEO and co-founder of the Justice Defense Fund and founder of Trafficking Hub Movement to hold Pornhub accountable, to actually shut down Pornhub and hold its executives accountable for globally distributing and monetizing the rape, trafficking, and child abuse of countless victims. And, you know, I came into this work through many years in this fight, realizing that trafficking wasn't just happening offline in the dark alleys and brothels and, you know, things like that, but was being filmed and it was being uploaded and monetized online. And so I was paying attention to the big porn sites and this, you know, intersection between sex trafficking and online pornography, specifically user-generated pornography, which is the primary way that this kind of content is distributed today. And there is a big porn industry, just like there's big pharma, big tobacco. It is dominated by one company, primarily called MindGeek, who owns Pornhub. And not only Pornhub, but most of the world's most popular porn sites and brands, YouPorn, TubeBait, XTube, GayTube, ExtremeTube, you know, I could go on and on, not only the tubes, but the pay sites and the brands. So I was paying attention in late 2019. There were some really concerning headlines that started to pop up. And one of them in particular was about a 15-year-old girl from Florida who was missing for an entire year, and she was finally found when her mother was tipped off by a Pornhub user that he recognized her daughter on the site. And she was found in 58 videos being raped for profit, and they were able to match his face from the videos with surveillance footage from a 7-Eleven and actually locate the girl, rescue her from his apartment. She had been impregnated. She was forced to have an abortion. It was just this horror story. Around the same time, the London Sunday Times had done an investigation. They had found dozens of illegal videos on the site within minutes, even children as young as 3. And it wasn't just children that were ending up on Pornhub. You know, I had read headlines that were so heartbreaking about a woman named Nicole Adamando from New York who was being raped, tortured by her partner. And he was filming the abuse. He was uploading it to Pornhub, and she actually killed him in self-defense, and she was sentenced to life in prison, separated from her 2 young children. It was such a heartbreaking story. And so one night, it was early 2020, it was February 1st, the dark hours before dawn on February 1st, 2020. And this is the story. This is the moment where my book starts, Takedown. And I had an idea. I decided that I was going to test the upload system for Pornhub to see how videos were getting uploaded to the site. At the time, in 2020, Pornhub was the largest and most popular porn site in the world. Not only that, but by the end of 2020, they were the 5th most trafficked website in the world. So not just porn site, but website. Researchers named them the 3rd most influential tech company on global society, just behind Facebook and Google. And this is the world's YouTube of porn. So they had 170 million visits a day, over 60 billion visits per year. And enough content uploaded every year, it would take 169 years to watch if you put those videos back to back. So I tested the upload system that night, and I realized what millions of people already knew. And that was that all it took to upload was an email address. They were not checking age, ID, consent. And because of that, the site actually became infested with videos of real sexual crime. And that's when all this began, suddenly, kind of unexpectedly, when I made this realization that because of that, Pornhub could have been the, you know, the largest collection, the largest repository of sexual crime in North America because of that. And that's when the trafficking hub movement started.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. Wow. Wow. And I know, you know, I remember hearing about, you know, World Series games, football games, when companies have their yearly meetings in some of these big cities, that's where a lot of trafficking also can take place in and around things like this and political rallies, et cetera. And when I hear about places in big cities where companies are having their yearly events, and I just wonder what's going on from, you know, behind the scenes. And then sometimes you just hear about horrible stories like the whole, you know, P. Diddy story and a lot of other musicians who, you know, people have called me about whose daughters have gotten involved in being held against their will. It's a very, very disturbing trend. And it's really an incredible thing, too, when you're working with some families like I've worked with where they scour the internet to find their children. And they have to go through video after video and seeing other people's children, which is, you know, traumatizing for them too. And they are hoping to find their child, and they're also hoping not to, because they're hoping that that's not where they have landed. But for some people, they are. There's also some cases that I've dealt with recently with families whose young daughters, whose teen daughters have started doing self-mutilation and cutting through sites on Discord where they need to film it and upload it. And they've wound up in psychiatric hospitals because of this. It is so rampant and so awful. And it's also something that in the cult world we deal with because there are groups like the Children of God where girls and women are taught to do something called flirty fishing, where they use their bodies to entice new members into this religious cult. So when they leave, they don't know what else to do. They don't know how else to make a living. And a lot of them go into porn or go into stripping. And, you know, that they also feel like that's all they're worth, which is certainly a tie into our whole realm here, just about not knowing, you know, what you're worth anymore once you're treated this way. There's also this other thing about consent. And we've had people on from the Consent Awareness Network because that is a whole other issue here. And one of the things that I talked about recently on the podcast was something that I learned recently about an additional definition to it, which is the word ongoing, that you have to give your consent in an ongoing way. Now, based on new information, based on what you now know about who it is that you originally gave consent to, it's not enough for you to say, well, I agreed to go out with this person or I agreed to follow this person into some room. I had no idea what was going to be happening to me. But a lot of people, even people in law enforcement, will say, well, but, you know, you agreed to it at the beginning. Yeah, but I didn't know the person was a monster, you know, and I didn't know what they had intended for me. And so now, luckily, in some legal circles that are more sophisticated, and it's going to take a lot for all of them to get there if they want to get there, to really realize that consent means in an ongoing way based on new information that you now have. So I'm wondering just about what you've seen about the wear and tear on people's psyches and how it changes their own self-concept while they're going through this.
That's one of the things that I think, you know, we need to try to understand as deeply as we can, and that there's, you know, so much more to learn from victims as we're, you know, just kind of getting our heads around this idea of having trauma distributed on the internet. Victims call this the immortalization of their trauma, where it's an instance of rape that happens or abuse, but then when it's filmed and then it's uploaded, not only, you know, it's not the dark web that these sites are, the mainstream surface web where Google is crawling these sites. Sometimes their name is in the title of the video, their school, their hometown, personally identifying information in the title, right? In the comments of these videos, they are distributed online. And then it's this, you know, kind of sadistic game of whack-a-mole that they play for the rest of their lives, where they keep popping up either on, you know, Pornhub or its sister sites or across the internet in other forms. And even if they don't pop up, like maybe they could go sometime, but they're always in fear that it will pop up. And so it's kind of like a constant terror. And it puts them in this perpetual state of trauma where it's almost like they can't heal because they keep having to re-experience the abuse. And then knowing that it's not just that they were abused, it's that people are getting money from their abuse and they're getting pleasure. Literally, people are masturbating on these sites, on these mainstream sites, to the worst moments of their lives that they know will now live on in perpetuity forever. You know, sometimes this kind of abuse gets diminished where people think it's just pixels on a screen, it's just a video. It's not, you know, it is so serious and so debilitating that, you know, I've heard from certain survivors that they feel like they can't even go outside of their house. Like they are afraid to go to the grocery store because they're wondering who in line who's watched their rape videos. And it's like a legitimate question, because when you have 170 million people visiting Pornhub every day, and at the time, like in 2020, when all this started, they had a download button on every video on purpose so that people across the world, millions of users per hour, had the opportunity to actually download and possess every single video, including the illegal content, and then be able to re-upload it again and again and again and again. And so, yeah, that's what, you know, one survivor said, my rapist put me in a mental prison, but Pornhub gave me a life sentence. And that was just a powerful way to state actually the reality of when these videos get uploaded.
Right. Right. Oh, my goodness. I'm thinking of this case in France that I'm sure you've been following.
Yes, Giselle. Right? Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yes.
And I think about all the men who have come forward who said, I had a feeling something was really wrong with what was happening and what I was participating in at the time. But still, a lot of them went through with, you know, raping her while she was drugged. I had no idea that it was happening to her. But there is sometimes, And I want to get into this, this code of silence and this lack of follow through, this feeling that I think people have sometimes when they're watching something and they get this sense that what they're watching or what they're participating in is wrong, but they keep going with it. Like there is this general desensitization, I think, and people then, it's like they say, well, if I'm getting pleasure from this, I can't also care about that person's experience and the trauma that I'm participating in. And so I'm wondering just about that, about people taking pleasure in this and that cutoff, that emotional cutoff and desensitization. What have you found out?
A really interesting place to be is in the comment section on Pornhub. On Pornhub in 2020, they had over 11 million comments on the site. So many of them on these abuse videos were horrified comments, you know, and I actually, you know, document these in my book. When I describe a particular video, I documented the comments on those videos because they were showing that the people who were watching the videos understood what was going on. This is a child. This is rape. This is sex trafficking. Take this down. Others were just, you know, kind of joking around about it, you know, saying like they loved the video. I wish that she cried more. I wish that I could have seen her face as she was in pain going through this more clearly, things like that. So you have this spectrum of reaction from different kinds of users who were witnessing the same thing and having these completely different reactions to it. And it's interesting. And I don't really know how to explain that, where somebody could watch a rape and be horrified by it, and another person is kind of just joking around and wishing they could see more or see more pain. And I don't know if you have an explanation for that, but it was really horrifying to know that there were so many comments indicating that these videos were abuse and Pornhub would ignore the comments. In fact, they would just censor the word child, the word rape, the word, you know, trafficking, and they would leave the videos on the site. And so, yeah, it was just horrible. But the thing that also is really concerning in this regard is the fact that children are accessing this content. So there's no safeguarding. So there's no, in 2020, there was not even an Are You 18 click-through button that any four-year-old could navigate through. I mean, now in the US, like they just have this Are You 18, click a button and then you can get through. But then they're on the site where they can actually witness a real crime scene as their sex education and their introduction to sex at 8 years old, at 10 years old. And Professor Gail Dines talks about what it's like for these children. She talks about describing, for example, a young boy who might see this violent content and they have what she calls a toxic stew of emotions where, in one sense, they're horrified and they're scared and they're, you know, actually in real time being traumatized by witnessing what's happening. At the other end of the spectrum, they're actually feeling arousal from watching it because that's just like a natural, like that's what happens, right? When you see nudity and things like that. And so they're feeling both pleasure and horror at the same time. And that is, it's like this toxic stew and it's so confusing. And then after they feel guilt, right? And they feel for having seen the violence. But then at the same time, they want to see it again because they actually got that release of dopamine and all of these different kinds of feelings that you get. So that I think is when all this starts, right? Is when these kids are being exposed and then getting hooked on this content from a very young age. And then the trajectory of what that ends up, you know, as they grow up.
It is a very disturbing thing. And I think about a lot of things as you mentioned this. One is the facelessness of it. I think people would be less prone, not prone, but less so if it were in person and or if it was someone they knew, if it was their little sister, right? I mean, it would be a whole other scene. And I think they would get enraged and want to kill the people doing this to her. But there is something about the fact that you feel like you're watching a show where you might actually not know if everyone is acting because there's some porn that people have said they were engaged in actually where it seemed violent. And then either at the beginning or the end, they said, we're just role playing. Don't worry, we're fine. But you also don't know if they were told to say that or if that's really how they feel. I mean, there's so much about it that's confusing to know if really you should be disturbed or you should just see this as really good acting. But I do think that people do feel that their bodies sometimes betray them. Like that doesn't, what their body is doing doesn't fit their conscience and they have to kind of reconcile it. And they are left feeling guilty because they know something happened that was really, really wrong. But I do think the desensitization after a while also does kick in. I hear that with people who were raised in abusive households, who were raised in very strict Bible-based, spare the rod, spoil the child, you know, environments where they were around very severe child abuse, or it happened to them, but it was for their benefit. No one seemed upset. The police were never called. It was all somehow part of the culture. So I think people get acculturated to this in a way that is really, really dangerous. And I'm wondering, you know, as we talk about this, I want to also hear from the perspective of the girls, the women who you've spoken with, and what they would want people to know or to watch out for, and sort of heeding their words here.
Yeah, that's one of the things that was really important to me in my book, Takedown, was you go on a journey of discovery with me. It's told in first person, present tense, and you actually get to meet the victims and, you know, hear a dialogue even in the things that they say about their experiences and the trauma and what they have gone through. And, you know, one of the things that is important is exactly to your point of this idea of it's a screen. There's this distance, there's disconnect between understanding that this is a person that's experiencing this harm and it's real. And also this idea of victim blaming, that it is so prevalent that these victims are blamed, that, you know, they say, oh, she just filmed porn that she regrets now, right? Like, no, it wasn't that. She didn't consent to this. And it gets, you know, conflated sometimes with the what you're talking about, which is the legal side of the industry, that sometimes actually, like you said, where it, like some of the most popular genres on these sites are very violent. Or, you know, teen, for example, was one of the most popular categories on Pornhub for years. And what was happening was teens who were actually teens, like that 15-year-old girl that I talked to you about from Florida, and so many others. I mean, there's 14-year-old Serena, for example, from Bakersfield, California. And she was an innocent 14-year-old girl, never kissed a boy before. She was a straight-A student, and she had a crush on a boy a year older than her, who convinced her to send him some nude images and videos, which she did. And then he shared them with his classmates. They got uploaded online, viewed millions of times. She would beg Pornhub to take these videos down. They would hassle her if they even answered. Often they would just ignore, hassle her, prove you're a victim, prove that you're underage. If she would get the video down, it would just go right back up. And this sent her on a spiral of trauma. She ended up dropping out of school because she was being bullied, got addicted to drugs to numb the pain. She tried to kill herself multiple times and then ended up homeless, living out of her car. And to the point of attempted suicide, what we know from surveys of victims of this type of abuse, we call it image-based sexual abuse, they have a near 50% rate of suicidal ideation because of the trauma. You know, so they would just say, this is not a regret. Like, I didn't just decide to make porn and then now I regret it. Like, no, like these are actual victims, but their abuse is side by side with, you know, 18-year-olds who are meant to look 16 and they're, you know, the studio produced porn. And then you have this user generated porn where it's actually a 15-year-old who's being raped in the video. And they are side by side, mixed up together. And from a moderator's perspective, you know, when they're, you know, if they're not verifying age and consent, and they only have 30 moderators, by the way, for all of MindGeek's PornTube sites. Now compare that to 15,000 for Facebook, but 10 per shift, watching up to 2,000 videos per shift, clicking through. But they can't tell the difference between a 16-year-old body and an 18-year-old body. They can't tell the difference between rough sex and rape. So it's impossible to decipher. From that perspective, it's a guessing game as to who is being victimized and who is actually, you know, a consenting adult who is engaged in this kind of porn. But I think victim blaming is a real huge problem. And I see that all the time when I post about these stories. Often they're just like, you know, I post about Serena and like, well, she shouldn't have been filming. It's like, really? Like that's the takeaway here. Like, no, she is 100% a victim of what happened. So I think that's important to them.
Yeah. And victim blaming. Okay. So let's talk about that, because that almost always happens. And I think victim blaming is a technique to make the listener feel more comfortable, where you don't actually have to address what's going on. You don't even have to feel the proper feelings with the stories that you've heard. You can just redirect things in this very cut-off way and project it back out to the person. And, well, why did you go to that party? You know, that kind of question. And why were you wearing that? And it happens also for people who've gotten involved in cults, who have really been mistreated or, you know, have dealt with neglect, have dealt with abuse. Well, why did you believe that guy? And why didn't you leave when you had a chance? And all the questions for them. And, you know, I've tried to encourage people when they are engaged in that, where they suddenly feel like they're on the witness stand, to not feel like you have to answer those questions, but to say to the person throwing all these questions at you, you clearly don't understand, and just leave it at that. And so I think sometimes that helps people know that they're really off base. You don't even have to explain how they don't understand. I mean, you can just say you clearly don't understand, or you don't want to understand, because I think that's also part of it. I think people just don't want to also know that they were involved in something that was really wrong, or they were turned on by something that was really wrong. And so I feel like it's so much of this is self-protective to just redirect out to the victim. It's also low-hanging fruit. It's all too easy to do that. But I think people don't realize how much they are re-victimizing the victim. And if they care even an ounce about the person, they should know not to do that, right? It's really an incredible thing. It just happens almost all the time. In fact, I was just speaking at a conference last weekend in Chicago for people who were abused within the Buddhist tradition, Buddhist temples, children who would come in as monks, you know, 7, 8, 9. And it's rampant in not all, but some places. And there's no system of checks and balances. Law doesn't get involved. The people who are in charge just say, yeah, that's how it is. And so, yeah, I want to hear from you. I think it almost feels like there's just an acceptance of it, that this is just how it is.
With regard to that, you know, the victim blaming issue is so critical in when you kind of zoom back, because when that happens, there's that connected shame. And the shame is what keeps victims from coming forward to be able to hold the abusers accountable, to speak out. And then the cycle perpetuates and we never get anywhere, because at the end of the day, if we don't have justice, if victims aren't empowered and feel like they can come forward without shame, then they won't take them to court. And then there will be no risk, right, for abusers. And when there's no risk, they just keep on going. You know, one thing we know with trafficking, and especially with this like corporate facilitated trafficking, is this is a risk benefit calculation. And we have to make the risk of continued exploitation greater than the benefit they get by maintaining the status quo. But that can never happen unless victims feel like they can come forward and they can speak out and they can go to court, you know. But this shame that comes with the victim blaming is what's holding them back, I think, in so many instances. And so it's like, from a big picture perspective, it's like, this is a real serious issue, because we're never going to address this problem on a bigger level unless we can allow, you know, like help survivors come forward. I love that Gisèle Pelicot in that the France rape trial. I mean, she's become like an icon, a hero to so many people. It's amazing, because she's just defiant. And her theme is shame must change sides. And it has to go from the victim to the perpetrator. And she's gone so far. I mean, this is really extreme, And I understand that many victims would never want to do this in a million years. And I understand why. But she actually fought to have the videos of her abuse shown to the court and to the public because she said, hey, shame must change time. I'm not ashamed of what happened. They should be ashamed of what they're doing in these videos. Powerful stuff, but it's just so important. I don't know if you have any ideas on how to actually stop victim blaming or like what is the antidote for it. I know that we can ignore those who do it, but do you have any sense of how we can actually help put an end to what's happening with regard to the blaming of victims of sexual abuse?
Right. So, you know, when people have left cultic groups, when they have been abused, when things have happened to them that were really, really wrong and without their consent, without their knowledge, they are the ones walking around feeling shame, feeling embarrassment. And sometimes it's just because that's how we are wired or because of the response they get that is directed at them. Even in the what seems like an innocent question of, well, why did you stay? There, I actually did a whole lecture that was entitled, Why Did I Stay? Because when I started thinking, how do I answer that question for people and help them answer? There were like 40 reasons that tumbled out of my head just from, you know, and they're all valid. And then I realized that's actually not the question to ask. It's, you know, where is this person and how do we make sure they never do this to anyone again? Not why did you, right? But what about them? And so redirecting even the questioning, even the support, like, let's see, let's understand why you got involved in that. And no, actually, let's maybe second, but first, let's talk about how somebody who really has an issue or might be a sociopath or whatever has done this to you and has no sense that they did anything wrong, or even if they did, they have a way of having kind of emotional amnesia about it so they can just make it through their day. And, you know, feel okay about what they're doing for a living. But I think for people sometimes who walk around feeling shame, I think it's because often the people who do these things to them are not capable of it. And if the person who did this to you had a sense of shame and conscience, and they said to you, oh my goodness, I grew up thinking this was okay, or my boss thought blah, 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 and they told me it was fine. I didn't realize. I am so sorry. I cannot believe I did this. I will never do this again. What can I do to help? There would actually be a lot less shame on the victim because they know that what happened to them is actually being acknowledged. And it's very clear that it was wrong. And so when you know, it's like you don't feel shame when someone breaks into your house and steals things, right? Because you know, that's very clear, right? Here you were just sleeping at night and someone breaks in, like it's clear who the culprit is, even though people will still say, how come you didn't get an alarm system? And how come you don't have a dog? And like, they'll still do that, but it's still a little clearer. So I think if we encourage the perpetrators to say certain things that really help the victim know that you're clear about who is right and who is wrong in this situation, I think victims will be able to walk with their heads held higher. And I also think that the notion that people, when they're questioned, it's also dangerous because we absorb those messages and we ask ourselves those questions then. So we re-victimize ourselves by saying, yeah, actually, why did I? It's also important for people to understand, yeah, so not only are they re-traumatizing themselves and re-victimizing themselves and re-shaming themselves by integrating those questions directed at them and asking themselves that question, those questions, and it's really important to not get into that cycle and say, yeah, what is wrong with me? But instead, what is wrong with that person who thought it would be okay to do that to me? There is something really important, I think, about people being able to connect with others, know that they're not alone, share each other's strength so that they know that they don't need to go into the shadows and they don't need to start living in their car and they don't need to just feel like their life is over. The other thing about shame that's interesting is that one of the things tied in with it is this idea that, and the law, unfortunately, has really upheld this problem, where there's this idea that once you are in danger, it used to be that you went into what we called fight or flight. But the thing is, when people are put in danger in this way, and a girl who's brought into a room with all these men and doesn't know what's going on, the last things that people do naturally are to fight or to flee. It's actually the least natural and also usually the most dangerous to try in either situation. Because unless you have a black belt, right? Don't try to fight. And unless you know you're going to be faster than everyone else, don't try to flee. It's just going to piss them off and you're going to pay the price for it. And so if we can get a message across to people that the things that people do most often when their adrenaline is rushing through them and they're in fight or flight mode, I want to change the name of that, is that they fawn and freeze. Those are the two most common things. And so if you realize that you were immobile, not because you wanted it, because that's what they will tell you, but that is the most natural response. And that's what your brain does. It shuts you down. Like, you'd have to figure out how to just stay safe, or you learn how to say just the right thing to fawn, to try to keep this person who is scaring you to not get scarier and to not get more dangerous. And so if those are the things that I think the legal system starts to understand and people working with victims start to understand are the most natural and safest responses a lot of the time, then victims won't blame themselves and they won't accept the blame and the reinterpretation of that as you must have wanted it because you were being so nice or you weren't getting up to leave.
So good. And I love this idea of, you know, what you said was get them to kind of confess, right? Get them to confess out loud that what they did was wrong and that that then, you know, obviously shifts the blame. Now, if they're not going to do that voluntarily, we're going to force them to do that. And that's where the work that I am passionate about with the Justice Defense Fund is to support survivors in holding their abusers accountable. And, you know, in that sense, I feel like justice can really be healing and really be kind of a repairing and removal of shame, not only for individual survivors, but for the group of survivors who are going through this to see abusers actually held accountable. Because what it means to them is, we see you, we see them, we know what was wrong. We know that this was wrong. It should not have been done to you. And therefore, they are going to pay. They're going to pay financially, right? In court, they're going to have to pay by, maybe their business is going to get shut down. Should be like that. You know, we call for Pornhub to be shut down and its executives held accountable, or they go to jail, because serious abuse demands serious consequence. And I think that it's important not to just give a slap on the wrist and let them go on their merry way. Not just because it doesn't deter future abusers, because that's true. Like, it's not going to deter future abusers, but also because it needs to happen to bring closure, to bring healing to victims who then can say, look, yeah, this was wrong and they had to pay. And I think that does really send a strong message to not only abusers, but to victims as well.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. And I think the consequences do have to be very severe, so that they're taken at all seriously. It would be wonderful for a consequence to be as life-changing as what the victim went through was life-changing. So however that translates for people, that they go to jail without bail, that they are never able to work again, they're never able to make a living or whatever it is, or that they're never, ever, ever able to have privacy again. Someone's going to monitor all of their emails, all of their website searches, everything. Even if they feel like they have protection, still there's a way to circumvent it. They're going to be watched forever, just like these women say they're watched forever. Something that feels akin to what the victim has experienced and will experience in an ongoing way, I think feels the most fitting.
Yes, I love that, that their life has to change from the consequence as much as the survivor's life changed from experiencing the abuse. That's a really good tool to measure with. Sometimes people are, you know, gosh, you've been hitting the same thing for years, like this, you know, Pornhub issue again and again is, you know, beating the drum. And is it like a, you know, broken record about this? But it's like, no, because we have to see accountability, the full extent of the law. And it does matter. And I speak to survivors all the time and they're like, no, we need to see justice fully served in order to get that closure, to get that ability to move on. They have to see not only for the individual perpetrator, obviously, we needed accountability for them, but then for those who then profited from, distributed, monetized, immortalized that trauma for that victim for the rest of their lives, I think is really important. We're hoping to see that actually happen. And then to prevent it too. Like, we need to make sure this doesn't happen again. And that's something I hear all the time from victims. It's like, they want justice served. They want reparations. They want to see prison time. But most important, like they want to make sure this doesn't happen to anybody again. And that is so important to them. And it's important to, yeah, all of us, should be important to all of us to make sure that doesn't happen.
Right. Yeah. And I think for there to be a much easier system of justice for the victims. I mean, I say this also knowing that I've worked with a lot of people who are in the process of suing their abuser or their cult leader or their cult. And most often they lose. And they have spent all their savings on it. And they went through the emotional roller coaster, or they were shamed as part of the process. And so we need to be able to shore up our legal system to have it be that it's not such a like pushing a boulder uphill all the time, only to have it come back and crash back on you. And I think just like that, you know, Pornhub can say to this person, yeah, prove to us that you're a teen. Prove to us that this, like, it shouldn't be that she's the one who needs to prove, or he or whoever is being abused has to prove anything. They have to prove something to people. They have to be the ones to prove that they're actually going to be safe. They have to prove that they're going to be following laws. They have to prove that when somebody says you need to take that down, they're going to do it in every corner of the internet where it could be. And anytime it's uploaded again, someone gets arrested. The proof should be, or the burden of proof should be on them, not on the victim.
Right. And that's why they ended up having to take down 91% of the entire website, came tumbling down because they could not prove that they were not victims in those videos. They had no proof that they're not children, teens, tweens in those videos, that they were not rape victims or victims of other forms of non-consensual image-based sexual abuse. That's why they lost Visa, MasterCard, Discover, PayPal, cut ties with them completely. You know, they have lost every major advertiser, every major business partner. The CEO and the COO were forced to resign. The secret shareholder who was hiding his identity for years was finally found. And now he's personally being sued by dozens of victims because they did not take that responsibility. And it was per policy, right? It wasn't an accident that these things happened. And I think, you know, it's, we just so often try to give a pass to companies, to executives who were engaged in this abusive conduct, just say, oh, it just slips through the cracks. Or it's just, you know, hey, this is the internet. Like, this is user-generated content. No, these were intentional policies that they were put in place and they were hiding it. They went 13 years without even reporting one single instance of child abuse they knew about to authorities. And that's against the law in Canada. And because they didn't want to damage the brand. So I'm encouraged by what's happened, but we have so far to go, not only for this particular behemoth of criminal abuse, but all the others that are, you know, like them out there.
Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking of people asking, like, why are you still at this? Like, really? But that's, I feel like that's more of just turning the focus in the wrong place. Like, clearly, if everything got resolved, I would move on. I have kids. I have a life. You think I want to be doing this every day, right?
100%. Yes.
Right?
Yeah,
like,
totally.
You do it because you have to, because there's still the need.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes.
And I'm just curious for you, before we finish up, what this is like for you. A lot of people are really worried about taking things on because they feel like it's just going to bring them down into some black hole, some abyss. And being able to compartmentalize, I get that question a lot. Like, how do you leave work at work? And so how have you found that, just balancing that all out?
Yeah, it has been, I mean, it's been a long trek, right? I've spent so many years pushing that boulder up a hill, you know, feeling that way. When all this began with Trafficking Hub and Pornhub in early 2020, I was at a really low point in my advocacy work. I felt like I had spent so many years trying so hard. And it was kind of like a collective discouragement in the anti-trafficking movement where the statistics are getting worse despite everybody's best efforts to try to stop this. But, you know, there was this moment that where things changed and suddenly that boulder reached the pinnacle and started tumbling the other way and gaining that momentum and that speed. And it has, as much as it's been so hard to look evil, you know, and just all of this straight in the face with so many videos of trauma that I've, you know, witnessed, but, and also the victims, have, you know, and all of this, right? The idea that it's pain with a purpose, like, and we're seeing in real time accountability, we're seeing progress happen has been really an important part of all of this. Because without that, if it was just like, we're staring this in the face and the abusers are winning, and like, I think that would just be crushing. You know, if people weren't paying attention and things weren't happening in the right direction, I think it would be so hard. But that, that was the feeling I had for a long time. And it feels different now. I feel hopeful and encouraged, but I'm not going to lie. There is definitely, you know, the darkest times when I just said, look, this is really too much and I don't know that I can keep going. Then you take a little break and then you just take a breath of fresh air and then you realize that, like, you're not going to get to the end of your life and wish you had not given up and then just keep going, right? And just, you don't want to have regrets. You want to look back and say, I did everything I possibly could to help put an end to this. And that's where I want to be at the end, like, not look back and go, oh, I wish that I had not given up on that.
That's so important. Oh my goodness. And so just as we're finishing up, where can people find you, your book, et cetera? And also, if people want to help this effort, how can they do it?
Yeah. So, you know, right now in the season, I think the most important thing that people can do is actually get the book and really immerse themselves into this issue, into the story, to meet the victims, to meet the whistleblowers, to understand this issue from a heart level and not just a kind of informational level. And through that, be empowered to actually take action. And my hope is that this, through the story, it's like, whether you care about this specific issue or something else, like whether you're facing something that's really big that you want to combat, there's a different injustice that you want to fight, that hopefully this would be an inspirational story. But 100% of all the proceeds from the sale of the book go to the Justice Defense Fund to help support this pursuit of justice. And so takedownbook.com is kind of the central resource where from there you can purchase the book. You can also sign the petition. 2.3 million people from every country in the world have signed the petition to shut down Pornhub and hold its executives accountable. And people are signing every day. And in 2025, we hope to finally be able to just print this out and go take it to Congress, take it to the UK government, to the Canadian government as well, demanding not only accountability, but also prevention. So preventative policy. And lastly, you could join from the website, takedownbook.com. You can join Team Takedown. So we're creating Team Takedown, which is a dedicated group of activists who are passionate about not only holding abusers accountable and taking them down, but also being able to take down this illegal content across the internet. So you can do those things at takedownbook.com.
Oh, I love it. It's one-stop shopping. You can do so much in the same place. And so I encourage everyone to go and check it out and sign up and get the book and be involved, because I know that's going to help a lot of people also feel like they are empowered to make a difference. That helps, it makes hearing these stories actually a little easier, because you want to get to the therefore, what I call the therefore, like, comma, therefore, I'm going to call this person. I'm going to do this.
Yes. Yeah. And I just will end with the fact that, you know, this movement to hold Pornhub and its parent company accountable not been a one-woman battle. It has been the battle of so many people coming together, 600 organizations, hundreds of survivors, journalists and attorneys and lawmakers and, you know, all of this coming together, and those in the porn industry, right? Those have been some of the most important allies in this fight. And it's just, to me, I'm so encouraged and so hopeful at what we can do when we come together, and that like every single voice matters, every single share, every like, every, all of that makes a difference. And to be able to witness that over the last, you know, almost 5 years has been so incredible. So I just encourage everybody, don't ever feel like you're too small. Like I'm not the, you know, leader of a nonprofit, or I'm not a lawmaker, therefore I can't do whatever. No, therefore you can, because lawmakers work for you. And a reader just the other day was like, I read the book and I went out and I got a meeting with my congressman, and now this is on their radar.
Wow. Okay. That is fantastic. Lila, you're amazing. And good luck to you in all of this effort all over and worldwide. It's a big thing to do, but you're right. If we all participate, it becomes a lot easier. But it sounds like already you've made so much progress, and I'm sure that is just reassuring that it's possible.
Yeah, but we have a long way to go, so we'll keep going.
Exactly, right on. Okay, really good to talk to you.
Thank you.
One more thing before you go. It is sometimes, I think, so important to cover topics that are difficult to cover topics that are unpleasant, that are topics that people would rather not know so much about. But part of the reason for this podcast is to shine a light on things that people might not know about, but also to be able to help draw people's attention to the connection between cults and these experiences, the connection and the through line being deception, being abuse of power, being intimidation, coercion, manipulation, and an unfortunate through line and connection is also how often the legal system and the courts are really unable, maybe ill-equipped, maybe unqualified, maybe just not ahead of the game, but way behind it, and then unable to step in to show people who have been trafficked, to show people who have been abused within religious contexts, to show people who have been raped on college campuses, as we talked about recently here, that people care and that the law cares, and that there are people out there who are going to protect you, and there are people out there who know a thing or two, and they know enough to know that it is very clear who the perpetrator is and who the victim is, and they will try to take down the perpetrators. I wish it were that simple. It should be that simple. It should be that clear. It's very clear even to a child who's watching one kid hit the other kid over the head to take their toy, who the victim is and who the perpetrator is. Why is it not as clear when we get into porn, when we get into certain environments that kind of dovetail these kinds of situations of religious persecution and rape that happens within certain contexts where it seems unclear if it was rape or if the person gave consent or if they didn't, and who the real victim is and maybe who it isn't. And suddenly it gets all gray when it really is black and white. Part of the reason that I think it gets gray is that sometimes people don't want their cultural institutions to be stopped. They don't want their cultural institutions and the things they rely on for their own pleasure to be stopped. And I have no doubt there are some people who will stop the whistleblowers just because they don't want to no longer have access to something they want to be able to access. When we talk about these kinds of subjects, we talk about a lot of cult environments too, because when you're dealing with cults, you're dealing with people who have been made to feel, I think, that they are kind of less than. And in order for them to have any kind of life, in order for them to have any kind of success, they need to follow everything they're told to do. They need to follow by these rules, these laws. They need to follow this formula in order to have a life where they can protect themselves, where they can support themselves, maybe even support their children. Within porn, that is offered as a possibility for a lot of people. And it is true at times. And this says so much about what's wrong with culture in general and society in general, I think, that there are times that people can make more doing something like this than being a classroom teacher, being a nurse. I also, though, think that what gets forgotten when people say, oh, well, someone can make a living being a stripper, or they can make a living being a prostitute, or they can make a living doing porn. What gets lost in that is at what expense and what kind of shape are they going to be in emotionally, physically, in every way once they go through this? This also dovetails the conversation about cults, because there are a number of cults where women, mainly, but also men, are subjugated, are made to be at the mercy of the leadership, where the leader and leadership in general feels they can do anything they want to other people and to their bodies. That somehow, if they signed up to be in this group, they signed up for that. And there are a number of cults, namely the Children of God, where women, girls, probably boys too, but mainly women and girls, are made to be prostitutes. Prostitutes for Jesus. To bring people in is called flirty fishing in this group. And there are other terms for that in other groups. And I've worked with a number of people who were involved in the Children of God. And a lot of them have gone into the porn industry, a lot of them have gone into sex work. A lot of them have gone into that because that's all they know. That's not all they want to do, but that might be the only thing they feel equipped to do. That might be the only thing also they feel deserving of in their life. Because of this work and because of hearing people's stories of needing to go and prostitute themselves in order to take care of themselves, in order to get off the street, in order to care for their child, or they need to strip in a strip club in order to support themselves. That's not something that I could ever find entertaining. Not that I ever really did before, but I remember being in New Orleans once and being in the French Quarter, enjoying wonderful music. And then next door to where we were listening to music was a strip club where everyone was just going in and enjoying themselves and doing whatever they were doing in the strip club. And I heard people say, Rachel, come on in. Oh, come on in. And I thought, well, I can't. Because I look up on that stage and I see a person who might be doing that because they were molested as children. A person who might have been involved in a cult where they learned that was the only usefulness for their bodies. A person who may be on the street or may have left an abusive partner, and this is the only way that they can support their children or support themselves or put themselves through school because their parents have abandoned them. I see the stories that I've heard. And I know that's not everyone's story, but I've heard enough of them in just the limited exposure I've had to people in these spaces in the world. I can only imagine there are thousands and thousands more stories like that. But when I also started to find out that a lot of these places were hubs for trafficking, that made it even more disturbing. That constantly these people are being preyed on in every direction by so many people who have the intention of using them and taking them even off the hands of someone who was using them before and sending them somewhere else to be used by someone else. These people, I think, are not seen as people. I know that Lila has a big job ahead of her, and it can feel like a really daunting task. But it is important that if you care about this issue, that you get involved in one way or another, whether it is to find out about the organizations that are doing work that are trying to help fend this off, or being able to let people know in government, to let people know in media, to let people know not to be supporting this anymore. I don't want to know about another family that is scouring the internet or scouring Pornhub, not because they're interested in porn, but because they're hoping, while still not hoping, that in one of the videos they come across, they'll finally find their child, just to know that maybe she or he is still alive and out there. And that's why families will say to me, we were really hoping we could find our child, but also not hoping that we would find them here. But we want to find them somewhere. And we think they've been trafficked. And we think they might be on Pornhub and be doing things where they're pretending to be enjoying it, but really crumbling inside and on a lot of levels, hoping to be rescued. So this is why I am taking the time to have Lila on and taking the time to talk about this and being really emphatic about how wrong it is that so many people out there who are just trying to get by are grabbed by cults, are grabbed by controlling partners, are grabbed by predators. I would love for the world to be a safer place. So I want to just make sure that you know about this happening to see if there's anything that you can do about it at any level. So at least you will know more so you can help get the word out. Take good care. Talk to you next week.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.